All right. First of all, before I forget, I want to tell you that what I say today in this recording is not just laboratory material. This is also lecture material. And eventually today I'll be showing you three slides from one of the chapters we haven't gotten to yet. But everything in here is both lecture and lab, so either you're responsible for this material for both parts of the course. One of the reasons is that the stuff I'm talking about today explains today's procedure and makes writing it up easier, but also I just can't fit this part of the lecture in the time given upstairs, especially when we have two holidays. Okay, anyway, what we need to talk about today are transport processes that can move things into or out of cells. And these are important, of course, because cells have to get things into them and out of them in order to remain alive. Well, there are three major categories of such transport processes, which are active transport, passive transport, and vesicular transport. Now, vesicular transport is a little bit weird compared to the other two. Vesicular transport is named for the fact that it involves vesicles. And I'll be describing it in greater detail in the lecture room. I just wanted to mention it as one of the three. The reason it's weird compared to the other two is that by using a vesicle, whatever the particle is that's going into the cell or out of the cell actually doesn't go through a membrane. It's kind of a cheating mechanism, in a sense. That's all I'll say about it here, though. We'll revisit that later. The other two, active transport and passive transport, can move things through a membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. And the distinction between active and passive transport is one of energy, but I don't want you to think that passive transport doesn't require any energy and active does, even if you've been taught that. That's wrong. Both require energy. Things don't move for free. They both require energy, even passive transport. But the source of energy for passive transport is built into the system. The source of the energy for passive transport is a gradient, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay? So passive transport doesn't require any additional expenditure of energy from outside of the system, whereas active transport does require outside energy to be expended in order for it to happen. That's the difference. Now, we'll talk a lot more about active transport upstairs eventually as well. But what I'm going to focus on today is passive transport, because that's what this whole procedure you're conducting is about. Passive transport is a directed process. It kind of might seem self-contradictory, but it's a directed process, meaning it happens in one direction, even though it is caused by random movement of particles. So you might be thinking, how does random movement end up moving things in one direction? Well, let's just cartoonize putting a sugar cube into a glass of water, for instance. I'm not going to draw the water molecules, but the sugar cube is made of sugar molecules, and right at first, right when you first plunk it into the water, there is a high concentration of sugar molecules where the sugar cube is and a very low concentration elsewhere, right? Well, that is a gradient. A gradient is a real general word that really means a difference. A gradient is a difference in values for some variable measured at two different locations. Yeah. Yeah, it's a difference in the values of some variable at two different locations. And there's all kinds of different gradients. For instance, what we call voltages are gradients of electrical charge. There's a different charge on one electrode in the wall outlet compared to the other one. So there's an electrical gradient. That's a voltage. There's a pressure gradient when you turn on a spigot. Higher pressure inside, lower pressure outside. There's a temperature gradient when you get two things at different temperatures touching each other. All right, and so on. So there's all kinds of gradients, but the kind of gradient we're worried about today are concentration gradients. Meaning, if you measure the concentration of some particle somewhere and measure the concentration of the same kind of particle some other place, if there's a difference, then that's a gradient, a concentration gradient. And that's what you have here in this sugar cube example. Now, any particles of any stuff, real stuff, are in motion. Even in solids, they're wiggling. But here we're looking at not solids, we're looking at solutions. So they are moving around. And they're moving around randomly. Every individual particle is moving at its own speed in its own direction. And that random movement is called Brownian motion. So that's the random aspect of this I was talking about earlier. But despite the movement of individual particles being random, passive transport results in movement of particles in one direction. And the direction that always occurs for passive transport is from where there is a higher concentration of that particle type to where there is a lower concentration. That's the directed aspect of it. So let's look at the cartoon again. At first, you have a high concentration of sugar where the cube still is, very low concentration, namely zero at first, where there is no sugar yet. But these, let's just stop time for a moment and consider these individual particles. Each one is moving at its own speed in its own direction. But we've frozen time for the moment. Okay? If I start time and let them travel, they're going to move in whatever direction they're headed until they hit something. Well, all the particles that are in the interior aren't going to get very far before they run into another sugar molecule. So they'll just be bouncing off of each other. The only ones that have a chance of leaving the cube are the ones that are on the periphery or on the edge. And even some of those will just randomly be moving toward the interior. So they'll also just bounce. But some of those edge ones will be moving outward, just randomly. And they therefore will leave this place and travel until they hit the wall of the container. And the more that happens, the more you reveal more ones that are on the new edge now. And therefore they will move away as well. So the movement, which is called net diffusion, is such that there is more movement away from the high concentration and toward the low concentration than there is in the reverse direction. Yeah, there is more movement away from the highly concentrated place to the less highly concentrated place than there is movement in the reverse direction. You know, because some of these sugar molecules that have left earlier will bounce around and come back toward the center. But at first, there aren't any that have left yet. So there's going to be none coming back. They can only leave. So, of course, there's going to be more movement away. And as long, just by the fact that there's more particles here than there are here, it's a greater chance that you're going to have a move from where they are more highly concentrated to where they're less highly concentrated. That is net diffusion. Usually when we say diffusion, we really mean net diffusion. Net diffusion means that there is movement in one direction more than the other. So that's the directed aspect. Net diffusion is directed. I said what? Well, if you think about it, just interrupt me again. Now, all passive transport, as I've already described it, is diffusion. Diffusion is always passive. All right? And everything we're going to talk about today is diffusion, but passive transport, or let me just start over. We use two different words, even though they're both diffusion. One is diffusion, the other is osmosis. Okay? Osmosis is diffusion, but it's a special case of diffusion. And so that's what I mean by saying that all passive transport is diffusion, whether we call it diffusion or whether we call it osmosis. Now, I haven't defined osmosis yet, but I will in a minute. All right? Now, for net diffusion to occur, you have to fulfill two requirements. First of all, there has to be a gradient. If there is no difference in the concentration, that's a zero gradient, or we just say the gradient doesn't exist. If there isn't any difference in concentration, then there will be just as much movement from A to B as there is from B to A. And so that's not net diffusion, that's just movement. All right? Net diffusion is movement in one direction more so than the other direction. So that's the first requirement. You have to have a gradient. And importantly, and I'll be repeating this several times in the lectures because we'll be talking about it for different reasons, especially in Unit 3, but importantly, any gradient, whether it's concentration gradient or any other kind of gradient, is a form of potential energy. It is stored energy that can do some work for you if things are set up properly. And that's why the concentration gradient, in the case of diffusion, is the source of energy that drives the movement. So it's not correct to say passive transport doesn't require energy. You just don't have to supply any from outside. It's already built in the form of the gradient itself. Did you have a question? Or did I answer it? Okay, now, diffusion, net diffusion, we'll look at, I'm going to show you a few slides. Let me turn this light off so you can see a little better. Do you want these off too? Okay. I'm still not quite to this slide. I have a couple more things to say. The sugar cube example, that is net diffusion. And notice that there was no membrane involved. So diffusion can occur in the absence of a membrane. That's the very simple case, the sugar cube example. But in biology, diffusion often is occurring through a membrane or across a membrane, however you want to phrase it. into cells or out of cells. And so that's what's being modeled here in this cartoon in the slide. This, it looks like there are six compartments here. There's really two. These three on the top are the same compartment, but at different times. And notice that the compartment is actually subdivided into two halves, separated by this dashed line. Well, that dashed line represents a membrane called a selectively permeable membrane. Permeable means able to permeate. Permeate means to go through. So a selectively permeable membrane is one through which certain kinds of particles can pass, but others can't. And this dashed line in this top chamber happens to be permeable to these orange dye molecules. Yeah. Selectively permeable? It means it describes a membrane through which only certain kinds of particles can pass, others can't. So the orange dye molecules can permeate the membrane. But notice that at first, which is the left time here, the left box, there is a gradient in place. Okay, well, I told you a little bit ago that there are two requirements for diffusion. I only gave you one of the requirements, though, which is a gradient, right? You have to have a gradient. Well, there is a gradient here. Importantly, though, you have to fulfill the second requirement for net diffusion to happen, which is there has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B. So you can think of the gradient, if it exists, as the tendency for diffusion to happen. But if the particle is blocked some way and it can't get down its gradient to go to the lower concentration area, then it won't happen. If they're both fulfilled, though, then net diffusion will occur. And both requirements are met here because I just told you that the orange dye molecules are able to get through the membrane. Therefore, they will. And so this is the same compartment later on. And if you let it go long enough, then the gradient gets dissipated. There's a steeper gradient here. We say it's a steep gradient when there's a big difference in concentration. It's getting less steep as more and more orange dye molecules move from the left to the right. And if you come back late enough and look at it again, then there is no more gradient in this example because the concentration on the two halves is the same. Now, that does not mean that the particles have stopped moving. It's just that there is just as much movement from left to right as there is right to left. And there, therefore, is no more net movement. That's a situation called equilibrium. When equilibrium is attained, there is no more net diffusion. And that can happen a couple different ways that we'll look at. One way is that the gradient gets totally dissipated. It goes to zero. When there is no more difference, then you've lost that one requirement for net diffusion and it stops. We'll look at a different way in a minute. They're in a different slide. All right, so that's just one particle type that we looked at here in this top example. The second example on the bottom is very similar. The difference is that we now have two different kinds of particles. But the important point here is that if there are multiple particle types, which there usually are, every individual type of particle has its own gradient that is completely independent of any other type particle's gradients. And the only reason why there is net diffusion of one particle type is because of its own gradient. That's the only thing that determines whether that type of particle will move in one direction more so than another. Okay? So we start out here with two gradients in place. One for the orange dye and one for the purple dye. Notice they are in opposite directions. Right? So there is a gradient in place for each. That's the tendency to diffuse. And since the purple ones can also permeate, both types of particles also fulfill the second requirement, being able to get from A to B. But the gradients being in opposite directions means the orange ones are going to move to the right, the purple ones are going to move to the left. The gradients get dissipated gradually until you get to equilibrium again. But what moves the orange molecules to the right has nothing to do with purple's gradient, and vice versa. Every particle diffuses or not just based on its own gradient. What's that? Okay, now that's diffusion through a membrane. Any questions on any of that? All right, well then let's talk about a subcategory or a special case of diffusion, which is osmosis. And this is particularly relevant to today's exercise because this is really a study of osmosis that you're doing with these potatoes. I need to start by telling you why it is diffusion and why it is a special case of diffusion by giving you a definition. The problem is most textbooks define osmosis, and I don't know whether you've read definitions of this yet or not, but most textbooks give you, phrase it in a way that makes it seem like it's an exception. I've already told you that all diffusion occurs from high concentration to low concentration. That's always the direction of net diffusion. And osmosis is a special case of diffusion, so it's the same directionality. That's the only way you can have passive transport, is from high to low. But most textbooks will say that osmosis is something like this, a definition something like this. The movement of water from a place of low solute concentration to a place of high solute concentration. Which is true. It just seems like it's backwards because it seems like something's moving from low to high rather than high to low. Well, before we get to that problem, though, let me say that first of all, you'll read that definition in biology textbooks, even though it's not always water that's moving in osmosis. Okay? There are two requirements that need to be met for diffusion to be osmosis. One is that the particle that's moving is not a solute, but a solvent. And that's why biology textbooks always say water, because in biology, the solvent is always water. But anytime you have a solvent that's moving, it could be osmosis. Maybe not, though, because there's a second requirement. First of all, it has to be solvent moving, not solute. And the second requirement is that it has to be, that solvent has to be moving through a selectively permeable membrane. And notice in my sugar cube, in the glass of water example, that was not occurring. Water, I didn't draw the water molecules, but water is surrounding the sugar cube at first. So there's a high concentration of water everywhere except the cube, a low concentration of water here. And so you have two gradients in place, just like the purple and orange dye molecules. You have a water gradient and a sugar gradient. Each type of particle is going to go down its own gradient. Water is going to move toward the sugar cube. Sugar is going to move away from the sugar cube. Right? That's diffusion of both types of particles, water and sugar. But it's not osmosis, even though water is a solvent, because it's not going through a selectively permeable membrane. So those are the two requirements. Those are the two things that makes osmosis a special case of diffusion. It's a solvent, not solute, and it's moving through a membrane. Okay, now back to this confusing terminology that most textbooks use. They say that osmosis is movement of water or solvent from low solute concentration to high solute concentration. I said that is true, but think about what that means. Low solute concentration really just means high water concentration, right? If a solution has a low solute concentration, that means it's mostly water. It's very watery. And so, yes, water moves from low solute concentration to high solute concentration, but that's just a backwards way of saying that water is moving down its own gradient from high water concentration to low water concentration. And that's really what happens, because water isn't moving because of the solute gradient, it's moving because of the water gradient. Okay. If that's happening through a membrane, and since water is a solvent, then it's osmosis. And we have that illustrated in slide 11. Here, instead of using a square chamber, we're using a U-tube separated at the bottom by a selectively permeable membrane, once again. And this time, you can see that it's a selectively permeable membrane because one of the particles can get through and the other type can't. Water can get through. The green particles, whatever they represent, can't. Okay, now there are two gradients, one for each particle type, green balls and water molecules. And so, since there's a gradient for each of those types of particles, each of those types of particles has the tendency to diffuse. That's the gradient. But the green particles don't fulfill the second requirement of being able to get from A to B. So they want to diffuse in a sense, but they're not going to be able to. Water molecules can, though. And notice on the left half, which is one solution, there's a lower solute concentration here, but that's just another way of saying it's more watery. There's a higher water concentration on the left than on the right. So water is going to, of course, go down its gradient. That's always what happens in diffusion. It's down the gradient. And therefore, water is going to diffuse, or osmose, from the left side to the right side. Water always osmoses toward the less watery spot. And it's less watery on the right side because there's a lot of solute particles there. We can see that detail on the bottom where we're actually showing the water molecules. Yeah?
So the green molecules up there cannot pass through?
Right.
The water.
Exactly. So there is a green ball gradient. They want to go from right to left, but they can't get through the small holes in the membrane. All right, so that's osmosis. But notice that as that occurs, as more and more water molecules travel from left to right, you're removing water from the left chamber and not replacing it with anything, and you're adding water to the right side without taking anything out. And that's why the levels of the liquid change. As osmosis occurs, the left volume gets smaller and the right volume gets bigger. Well, this picture is drawn so that it looks like this has come to equilibrium for the same reason that we talked about equilibrium before, meaning the concentrations are equal on both chambers now. That's because as you add more water to the higher concentration on the right, it dilutes that solution, right? Brings the concentration down. And when they're equal, that is a completely dissipated gradient, so there's no longer any tendency for water to diffuse, to osmose. So that's just another example of the same thing. But I told you earlier that there's another way that you can come to equilibrium. Not in this picture, but you can easily imagine this. So start out exactly the same, except on the left half, pure water, no solute at all. Okay? Obviously, there's still a gradient in place for water. It's more watery on the left, less watery on the right, and therefore it's going to move to the right. Well, as more and more water moves, you are diluting the right side once again. So the solute concentration is going down. It's becoming more watery. But no matter how much water you put in there, since there's still some solute, getting more and more dilute, but there is still a higher than zero concentration of solutes, no matter what, right? It's never going to be pure water like it is on the left. So you're never going to get to the point where there's no gradient. It's always going to be more watery on the left. You see what I'm saying here? It would still come to equilibrium, though, even without the gradient being totally dissipated or going to zero. And that's because as you add more volume to the right, the level gets higher, and it's being pulled more and more by gravity. Those are completely opposite forces. Osmosis is trying to force the level upward. Gravity is trying to force it downward. And when those two, and the magnitudes of those two forces exactly equal each other, then that will be another reason it would come to equilibrium, even though there's still a gradient in place. Okay. Now let's look at 12, and I need to give you some more definitions. It's time now to talk about tonicity. Tonicity refers to the tendency for osmosis to occur into or out of a cell. So we're talking about a situation in which a cell is surrounded by a liquid medium, which they are in your body, right? There's intracellular fluid, that's inside the cell. There's extracellular fluid, that's outside the cell. Those are two different solutions separated by a membrane, the plasma membrane of the cell. And so there's opportunity for osmosis to occur. And tonicity refers to how strong a tendency there is for osmosis to occur and in which direction. But tonicity is the real general word. There are different categories of tonicity, and that's what the columns on this figure show you. So notice the words hypotonic, isotonic, and hypertonic. These are also confusing terminology-wise. Let me explain why. Well, actually, even before I do that, let me warn you that I don't know about this new version, whether it's been fixed, but the author of the lab manual has made mistakes about the use of these words before. So go by what I say if you find any difference in the manual. These words, hypotonic, isotonic, hypertonic, should only ever be used to describe the environment, not the cell. The extracellular stuff is either hypotonic, isotonic, or hypertonic, not the cell. So if she says the cell is hypertonic, that's wrong. Don't use these words to describe the cell. Okay, now back to the confusing part of the terminology. They all have tonic in there as the root, but they have different prefix, right? What does hypo mean as a prefix? It means below, yeah, like in hypodermic, below the skin. The reason this is confusing is because we're talking about osmosis, which is movement of water, which occurs only because of the water gradient, as I was talking about. But yet these words are named not for the water, but for the solutes in the environment. And that's why it's kind of backwards and confuses the hell out of people at first when they're first learning this. So hypotonic, yes, hypo does mean below or lower, but a hypotonic solution is one that has a lower solute concentration than the cell does. And that's just a backwards way of saying that a hypotonic solution is more watery than the cell. Right? So get that in your head. Hypotonic always means more watery than the cell. And that's really what matters, not the solutes, because water is going to follow its own gradient, the water gradient. By the way, saying that hypotonic means more watery than the cell brings up an important point about these, another important point about these terms. Each of these three terms is relative, not absolute. It doesn't make sense to say that this solution is hypotonic, absolutely. It only makes sense to say this solution is hypotonic relative to this cell. It's always a comparison. All right? So it depends on the cell as to whether the surroundings are hypotonic or not, because you have to compare it to the cell. But hypotonic means more watery. And therefore, there is a gradient, right? If it's more watery one place than the other, there's a gradient of water. It's less watery inside the cell. Water always moves down its gradient, so it's going to move, in this case, from more watery to low to less watery. It always does. But in this case, less watery is in the cell. And in the top row, we have an animal cell, a red blood cell representing an animal cell, to illustrate what happens. Now, animals, we haven't gotten into this quite yet, we're getting close, but animal cells, like all cells of any organism, has a plasma membrane. All cells that have ever existed have a plasma membrane. That defines the cell. But in the case of animal cells, that's the only covering they have. Plants are examples of organisms that, in addition to having their own plasma membrane, of course, they have a much thicker and sturdier cell wall outside of the plasma membrane. Animal cells don't have that. So we'll talk more about plants in a second. But in an animal cell, in a hypotonic environment, in an environment that's more watery than the cell itself is going to take in water, because water is moving from more watery to less watery. It's coming into the cell. And that, of course, is going to increase the volume of the cell, so it's going to stretch the plasma membrane, which, compared to a cell wall of a plant, is much flimsier. And if the gradient is steep enough, or if the cell is exposed to that hypotonicity long enough, it will actually burst the plasma membrane, which is what's shown here. And I shouldn't have to tell you that's bad for the cell. It kills the cell. And that bursting, by the way, is called lysis. Lysis is the noun. Lysed is the verb. This cell has lysed. It's undergone lysis. Just like in the word hydrolysis. It meant splitting, right? Here you're splitting open the plasma membrane. Lysis. And so animal cells do not do well in a hypotonic environment is the point. Now let's look at the other extreme before going to the middle. Hyper is the opposite of hypo as a prefix. Hyper means above. But once again, remember that it's referring to the solutes, not the water. So a hypertonic solution is one that has a higher solute concentration than the cell does, which is a backwards way of saying that a hypertonic solution is less watery than the cell is. You see that? Well, that just means the gradient is reversed in direction. But water, once again, as always, is going to move from more watery to less watery. In this case, though, it's more watery in the cell than outside, so water is going to leave the cell by osmosis. And that, of course, is going to cause shriveling of the animal cell. That shriveling is called crenation. With an N, not an M. So this cell has crenated or shriveled That's also not a healthy situation. If it's severe enough, that will kill the cell as well. So animal cells don't do well in either a hypertonic or a hypotonic environment. Iso, as a prefix, means same, like in isomer and isotope. So an isotonic solution is one in which the overall solute concentration of that environment is the same as the overall solute concentration inside the cell, which is a more complicated way of saying that the environment is equally watery compared to the wateriness of the cell itself. But there's an important point to make here. In that definition, I didn't say anything about the types of solutes, because it doesn't matter. All that matters is the wateriness, because water obeys only its own gradient. So if you imagine a cell that has, or a bag, a cell-like bag that you could make that has a internal solution, it's containing a solution that is, let's say, one molar glucose, and then you put that into an environment that is a solution of one molar fructose. Two totally different solutes, right? But that's not what matters. If they're both one molar, even though they're different solutes, that means both solutions are equally watery. And so that would be an isotonic situation. And water is just as likely to move into the cell as it is to move out of the cell. That's what isotonicity is. There is no net osmosis. There's just osmosis in both directions equally, as you see here by the two arrows. And that's the healthy situation for an animal cell, isotonicity. And that's why we, an important part of our homeostasis as animals is to maintain osmolarity, maintain concentrations of the extracellular fluid so that our cells don't burst or shrivel. All right, well, let's compare this to plants. Just looking at one plant cell on the bottom. If you put a plant cell into a hypotonic environment, it's the same situation as for animals, of course. Hypotonic means it's more watery, and therefore the water wants to come into the cell, and it will. But the plant cell, unlike the animal cell, has a sturdy cell wall outside of the plasma membrane. The plasma membrane is kind of like the paint on the interior of the wall itself here in this room. This room would be a plant cell. The structure of the wall is the cell wall. The flimsy paint on the interior surface of the wall is the plasma membrane. Well, that sturdy cell wall is going to be able to handle the pressure as water comes in more and more. And eventually it'll come to equilibrium because the force of the wall pressing, trying to squeeze water back out, will equal the force of osmosis trying to bring water in. It's another example of equilibrium. But that'll happen in a situation in which the plant cell is swollen or turgid. And that's the ideal situation for a plant cell. Now, a plant is not just one cell. It's trillions of cells, right? Even in a tiny plant, even in a little seedling. Now, think of a seedling. It's all soft stuff. But it'll stand straight up when it's growing. It's really an erection. Because if you give it water, that is, if you give it water, that you're making that environment hypotonic, and the water is coming into the cells by osmosis, causing each one individually to swell, but that means all the neighboring cells are pushing on each other, and that's what makes it stiff. Very similar to an erection in a penis, except it's not blood pressure causing it, it's osmotic pressure from the water you gave it in the soil, if you remember to water it. And if you don't remember to water it, eventually it will no longer be a hypotonic environment. And it won't be swollen. It will be flaccid when it gets to isotonic. and that's when it won't be able to stand up anymore. And if you rescue it in time, give it some water, return it to hypotonicity, it will stand back up. So plants do best in a hypotonic environment. They can survive isotonicity, but it's not ideal. And if you give them a hypertonic environment, the water is going to leave them just like it leaves an animal cell, but the cell wall is not going to collapse. It's strong enough to stand up to the loss of water, but the water is actually inside the plasma membrane. So when it leaves, that flimsy plasma membrane peels away from the wall, and that kills the plant cell as well. Be careful with this word. When that happens in a plant cell, it's not called crenation like it was for an animal cell. It's called plasmolysis. That's the noun name of the process. I say be careful, though, because plasmolysis includes lysis, but it's really the opposite of lysis, right? Lysis is the rupture of an animal cell in a hypotonic environment. Plasmolysis is the shriveling of a plant cell in the case of a hypertonic environment. Any questions on any of these definitions or concepts? Okay. Then I just want to say a couple more things about the actual experiment you're conducting. Yeah.
Handle, or like, for instance, some plants can grow like solely in water,
yeah,
and then some of them can't.
Well, that is not because of osmosis, though. That's because of inability to get gas to the tissues. There's only so the air has a lot higher concentration of oxygen than water does. There's oxygen dissolved in water, but some plants can't handle that low concentration. And that's why you have to drain the pot if you have a potted plant. If you just fill it with water, then usually the root system will die. There are certain species that can handle it, but most can't. Okay, now, when you write this up, it's, once again, you just follow the specific instructions that's in this chapter of the manual. And by the way, all you have to do today is get your final data and draw your whiteboard picture and get snapshots of that. In other words, get your raw data. Don't try to write the report starting today. In fact, I don't want you to start writing the report until you've already gotten a grade for your first report. Okay? So just get your raw data today. Make sure you have all your raw data. But following the instructions for the write-up of the report is pretty straightforward, except for one part that throws people. Two things I want to say, though, including that one part. And one of them has to do with graphing. What do you put on an x-axis in general? Independent variable, which is what today? The concentration of sucrose, right? The concentration of the sucrose solution. And which values are you using? No, I mean, what are the values? Not the units. 0, 0.3, 0.5, right. I can almost guarantee you that even though I'm telling you all not to do this, some of you are going to do this. Just because it happens every term. Making a graph. 0, 0.3, 0.5. What is wrong with that? Right. These are numbers. If you look at a number line, there's not the same distance between 0 and 0.3 as there is between 0.3 and 0.5. So don't do that. This is an example of a category axis. If this was red, green, and blue, for instance, or Volvo, Mercedes-Benz, and Toyota, yeah, they wouldn't be space. They wouldn't have to have different spacings that are just categories. These are numbers, though, and a numeric axis has to have correct spacing. And that really matters because it's going to affect your line of best fit. So don't do that. Do it correctly. Speaking of the line of best fit, well, something else before that. I mentioned a little bit earlier that your raw data really are your individual weight measurements or mass measurements. But that's not what you graph in this case. So don't give me a graph that gives mass as you measured it directly with the scale. Instead, the reason you are making two measurements of mass is that you need to calculate the change in mass. That's what you should be graphing, the change in mass. And in science, we represent change with a delta notation, right? Change in mass is a difference. There's two ways you can compute a difference, though, right? A minus B or B minus A. Well, there's a correct way of doing change in some measurement, like mass. Change in mass is mass final minus mass initial, not the other way around. Here's why that's important. Let's say that your final mass is greater than your initial mass today. What does that mean if that happens? If your final mass is greater than your initial mass, what does that mean in common sense terms? Means that there was a gain in mass. Exactly. Well, if you define change in mass this way, greater minus lesser is going to be a positive number. So a positive change in mass means a gain. But if the final mass is less than what you started with, that means you've lost water. Well, that's going to manifest itself as a negative number. Smaller minus larger equals negative. All right. So make sure you calculate delta correctly. But it's the change in mass, not the mass, that you need to be plotting on your graph. Properly labeled, of course. I'm just putting it up here to remind you that it's change. Now, you're accustomed to looking at graphs, because many of them do, with zero at the left edge and zero at the bottom edge of the two axes. That's sometimes appropriate, but not always. Here you might be getting negative changes in mass, right? So zero should not be down here on the bottom of the vertical axis. It should be somewhere in the middle so that you can have room for positive values and negative values. Is that clear? I don't know what your data will look like, but I'm just going to put three dots in here representing three data. They aren't perfectly collinear, as you would expect for real measurements, but they look like they are trending, right? So you're justified in drawing a line of best fit, only with a ruler. Don't skip that step. And just like I talked about in general when we spoke about graphing before, a line of best fit can be used for interpolation, which is prediction, right? Well, here, this brings me to the part that most people get confused by. I'm going to tell you exactly how to do this, and I'll see how many people obey me. Because I tell exactly how to do this every time, and a lot of students just ignore that advice and give me some nonsense. But the confusing part of the write-up is the question that asks, what is the solute concentration of the potatoes? Well, you're not measuring any solute concentrations today, right? So how can you possibly answer that? All you're measuring are masses, and you're able to calculate change in mass. How can you figure out what the solute concentration of the potatoes is simply by a change in mass measurement? Well, this has to do with the definition of isotonicity. What did I say isotonicity means? Go ahead. Right. That's exactly right. The wateriness is what matters for the movement of water, but here we care about the solutes. An isotonic solution has the same solute concentration as the cell does. The only concentrations you know today are the environment concentrations, right? Because you're setting those. That's your independent variable. 0, 0.3, and 0.5, you know. Well, the line of best fit corresponds to other values of concentration that you didn't measure. It's interpolation, right? But if you did have a perfectly isotonic solution, what would happen? Zero change in mass. That's how you answer this question. You know what the solute concentration is inside the cell if you know what the concentration of an isotonic solution is. An isotonic solution is going to cause a zero change in mass. So you just go straight from zero on the y-axis over to the fitted line and then straight down and read whatever that concentration is. This concentration would be predicted to make a zero change in mass, and therefore that concentration must also be what the concentration is inside the cells by definition of isotonicity. Does all that make sense? Okay, so answer it that way to get credit. Another thing about credit is that you're making a drawing on the whiteboard today, one per group, and you should call me around to approve it before you take a snapshot. But make sure that everyone gets a snapshot before you leave and before you erase it. Because if you insert that snapshot into your report, you get bonus points. You don't want to waste those. That's really all I wanted to say about the potato thing. You also, though, are supposed to be looking at these displays, and this confuses a lot of people as well, because let's just look at these strawberries. People see two containers of strawberries here. It is true that there really are two containers of strawberries, but it's supposed to be one container. That's why it's always important to read labels. It's supposed to be the same container before and after. So make sense of it that way. This is not two containers. This is the same container later. And that's, you're supposed to describe what has happened. And similarly for the raisins. Okay, so just make sure when you... there's nothing magic about 60 minutes, by the way. So now that I'm done, or as soon as I quit talking, that'll be time to get your final weight. Just make sure you shake them off to the same degree you did originally to get good final mass. Yeah. Yeah.